This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country and join their calls for justice. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
The Greens Party is a party of hatred.
They're not green. They don't seem to care about the environment.
As the Greens are kryptonite to the federal Labor government, so the Greens will be kryptonite to the state Labor government.
Frankly, I've always found the Greens to be a real serious danger to Australia.
Serious danger to Australia.
Good afternoon, Danger Dogs. How are we going? Welcome to Nam Melbourne, the greatest city in the world.
In your face, you're not from here.
Welcome to Serious Danger, a podcast about green politics in Australia. I am Tom Ballard.
I'm Emerald Moon.
And this is not an official Greens Party podcast.
Not an official Greens Party podcast. Not an official show of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival.
No, either. We did not pay them $500. Fuck them. But it is made possible with the help of the Green Institute and produced by Michael the Griff Griffin, who's in the house. We should also make clear, we did not make that video.
No.
You saw it on social media just before the show started and you loved it so much.
And Tom got really angry at me for being like, can we please play this video? And he's like, it's going to fuck up. It's going to ruin the whole show. No.
I was worried that you'd think that we made it, whereas we love Adamant. He's our leader.
Yeah, no, I want to thank Advance Australia for managing to make Adam look that cool. But please stop taking private jets.
Adam. Yes.
Really embarrassing.
If
actually.
Possible, that'd be great. Thank you for coming out and selling out our second live show in Melbourne, everybody. How good is this? Fucking legends. We really appreciate it very much indeed. Osman Faruqi is here. He's going to be here a bit later on. Give it up for Oz. And yes, it's not an official Melbourne Comedy Festival event, but the Comedy Festival is on. You are here in Nam Melbourne at the time when everyone's laughing. Emerald, are you excited?
I'm so excited. You asked me if I was doing anything tonight. Tom's like, are you going to see any shows? I mean, I've been doing some shows, he said. But I'm thinking maybe I shouldn't go because I heard you got a bad review.
So. I did not get a bad review.
Really?
I got an amazing review that I've let go and I just have it here on my phone. This is for The Age, all right? Now, if the people who read The Age don't like me, I'm truly fucked. But look, you can look it up yourselves. But the last paragraph is what really got me, all right? You know where you stand with Ballard. You're not going to get much in the way of banal observational comedy. But if you want an hour of blistering attacks on the right wing of Australian politics, his show is the perfect balance of mean and funny.
That's perfect.
Hang on.
Oh.
The perfect balance of mean and funny, 3 stars. Fantastic stuff. The perfect balance.
Perfect. Perfect.
3 stars.
Yeah, perfect. 3 out of 5. That's right. 60%. Okay. A passing grade at least.
Yeah. What's that? Peace to get degrees. Peace, yeah, I guess degrees. I pass there. I pass for comedy. I've been having a lovely time. Anyone seen my show yet? Yeah. Brutal. Okay, Jesus. Ooh. Thank you very much. You get a mention in the show, Emerald. Are you pleased to know?
So I heard. Yeah. What mention do I get?
Well, I talk about how I slightly to the left on most political issues than the average Australian. I'm a Melbourne-based Greens voting homosexual socialist, atheist, ABC comedian and cyclist who co-host a podcast about the Greens with a woman from Mullumbimby named Emerald Moon. And
that's what Mum intended when she named me. She wanted to be a joke in a 3 out of 5 star comedy show.
The perfect balance. The perfect balance. I've had some incredible fucking heckles from political nerds. I have a joke about Penny Wong being jealous of Anthony Albanese and there's going to be a leadership spill and she'll take over. It's part of a very funny.
Because women are jealous? Is that what you mean, Tom?
Yeah, it's in the men's rights section of the show.
Right.
Anyway, I just make a joke like, oh, Penny Wong might be the new prime minister. And a guy yells out, she's in the Senate.
No other comedian is getting heckled with constitutional questions. That's a little Tommy.
You bring it upon yourself.
I had a no voter in as well. I talk a lot about the referendum. Had a no voter in. That was very tense. Because I introduced the topic of the referendum at the 15-minute mark, and this guy was like, oh, it's a waste. And I was like, what's that, mate? It's like, waste. I was like, did you mean like a waste of time to do the referendum or a wasted opportunity for the nation? And it was the former.
It was the former.
He had a very uncomfortable 40 minutes. Yes. And I also had a Labour heckler at one point as well, a guy who said, I did a Labour joke about...
Welcome to Serious Danger, the show where we review Tom's own comedy shows. And he just lets it all out. Is this therapy for you, Tom?
It's better than 3 stars! He just yelled out at one point, he said, pass the housing. Like I was being a bit pro-greensy, a bit shit. It's just pass the housing. And I said, what, mate? And then he said silent and didn't respond again. And then I said, and this is funny, you'll like this.
Okay, sure.
I said, oh, a Labour supporter gave up easily. That's weird.
Sit down.
The perfect balance.
You look wonderful. We were worried about the fashion before the show as well.
Yeah, I was having a fashion crisis. I saw the stupid fucking the April Fool's Melbourne City thing with wearing all black. And then I realised after I got here and saw that Tom was also wearing this, we've really played into their hands.
We look great.
I just want to fit in. Don't we all just want to fit in?
See, I think you have the heart of a Melburnian within you.
How could you say that to me? That's fucked up.
Don't you think?
No.
All right, fine. We'll move on then.
Okay.
We should say a big thank you to our patrons, our wonderful patrons who support the show for just $3 a month. You get bonus content. Any patrons in?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Danger Dogs. Thank you to Linda, Jacob, Riley, Anna, Al, Jessica, Oliver, Taz, Andy, and Sebastian. We love you very much. Thank you
love
for supporting
you super,
our show.
Super much. Love thank you.
Love you. 3 stars.
We should announce as well. 3 stars. Yeah, perfect. We should announce as well. Thank you for coming to this show. I don't know if anyone's thinking of, flying up to Brisbane, but since we will also be releasing this to the rest of the world. That's right. People listen from overseas. But we have the upcoming show in Brisbane, Mianjin as well. We have 2 shows because we sold out the first one. And we can announce we have some extra special guests who will be joining us. The sold out 2 p.m. show, Councillor Trina Massey, recently re-elected. Fuck yeah, Trina. And the added midday show at 2 p.m. now as well, Mr. Max Chandler Mather will be joining us. So
you hear that, friendly
tickets.
Geordies?
Yeah.
We're going
around
again.
He should
just
come along this time and just fight. We'll just fist fight.
Be great. We should get him on too.
Yeah, we should. We keep asking.
No. I think there are still a few tickets left for the midday show in Brisbane. So people listen to this, you want to come along and manage in Brisbane, we'd love to have you along there. That'll be another great chat with Max, who's been fighting the good fight on housing in the previous weeks. We've got a little bit of business to get to. Two other quick stories I wanted to get your thoughts on, Emerald Moon.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new Governor General coming, baby.
Finally.
Tough crowd.
No cheers. No cheers for King Charles.
No. Well, gracefully, His Majesty has approved the appointment of our next Governor General, prominent businesswoman Samantha Boston. Let's give it up for King Charles, everybody. Come on. I just think it's nice that he approved. He lets us choose his own little representatives.
It's really nice. Yeah, a little lucky. Yeah.
Sam Boston will replace the current Governor General, David Hurley, from July 1st this year. She'll be the 28th Governor General and the second woman ever to hold the role.
Now, yes.
Emerald, you're a woman.
Slay.
Do you find that inspiring?
That is so inspiring. You know what? You can't believe, you can't see what you're not.
finishing the cliche. Isn't that a lovely message to all the little girls out there that they can grow up to be the unelected representative of a decrepit institution of pedophiles and lizards? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Sign off and be like, yes, the king approves.
Yay. Mm. A bit of her background. I mean, she's so qualified. She's fantastic.
She
qualified.
Is.
I love the qualifications. Sam Austin is a former lawyer. She was associate to Michael Kirby back in the day. She was the senior communications policy advisor to Paul Keating. Your dream job. She was the first woman appointed to the AFL Commission. She's the board director for the Sydney Swans. She has done lots of non-profit work, but also a senior executive at Insurance Australia Group, Optus, Cable and Wireless Group, and senior non-executive roles at Transurban, Virgin Australia, and she's also been the chair of Citibank Australia. Pretty cool.
Certified girl boss.
Shio alert. But like, I've, you know, there are all these fucking glowing coverage about how amazing Sam Austin is and all these people talking about who know her. And they're like, she's so qualified. She's got all the skills that you need to bring. And no one says at any point what the fuck the Governor General does.
No.
Or how any of this experience will actually apply to her doing the job. And it's the same bullshit with all the monarchy stuff, which is, oh, it's just a symbolic position. They don't have any real power. But also it's fantastic that it's her because she's a great advocate for stuff and she'll have some kind of an effect.
Yeah, she's so qualified at being a powerful person. Yes. Like, yeah, who knows?
Very strange. The big problem, of course, is that she's woke.
Okay. You should have led with that, Tom.
Because
I was getting excited.
I thought you would have known that when I told you that she worked at Transurban and Citibank.
Transurban. Well, you know.
I identify as urban. Mom, Dad. Mossad is a Republican. She's criticized Australia Day, which is the worst thing you can possibly do, of course. And she's also said, Black Lives Matter is teaching us about what it means to have a privilege, and I think that rests very heavily in Australia. The education that I had didn't tell us about the 60,000-year rich history of Indigenous ownership of the land, which was never ceded, which was then taken by the occupiers that came to create the nation we now call Australia. So, like, okay, should a Republican accept the position of Governor General?
Is she doing change from within?
Change from within!
I mean, we know it works, right?
Every time. I guess if you had a real Republican who just made King Charles's life a living misery, I'd be on board that.
Yeah, like, is she going, I don't know, is she going to assassinate, like, get close and just, I think he's on the way out, isn't he?
Yeah, I don't think she
doesn't need to do much. Well, now's the time.
God.
Oh, don't grow. Oh, make one joke about killing someone. Fucking hell.
The woke brigade strikes again.
Yeah.
At the Serious Danger live show. Cancel culture, yes. Of course, the right have lost their minds about Sam Austin because she's so woke. Matthew Sheen, Executive Director of Advance Australia, who made that wonderful video, described the appointment as an insult to mainstream Australians and claimed her elevation revealed Albanese cared more about the activists and elites than the people working hard to make this nation great.
He loves activists. Yeah, Labor, they love activists, famously.
They're crazy about them. The activists that endorse all their policies, yeah. Mossad is the worst kind of corporate activist who campaigned against the majority of Australians in the divisive voice referendum. So basically, I guess the next Governor General had to be a no voter, I suppose.
Right, yeah, they should have.
To advance Australia. Yeah. In social media posts, she is now deleted. She's argued to change the date of Australia Day, which she has also referred to as Invasion Day.
That's interesting that she deleted them.
Well, this is crazy.
Did she do a scrub?
Apparently, John Ruddock, who's the Libertarian Party in New South Wales Parliament, he tweeted, we should have a constitutional amendment that bans anyone from serving as our Governor General if they wipe their social media accounts before accepting the job.
Wow. It doesn't matter what you've said, but you've got to leave it up there.
You've got to leave it up there. And so he wants a referendum to change the constitution. The
more
first
referenda.
Mention of Twitter in our founding document.
Yes. No post. No post scrubbing. Yeah, never delete. Never back down.
Never back down. It is weird that you delete all that stuff, really. Jen Albritton, Governor General role is cushy job for the wokest of women. Now, this is
the
good.
Wokest
this
of
is
women.
The opening line to Janet's piece. If someone offered me the role of Governor General, I'd say, shoot me now. Guys,
dramatic.
I think we should offer Jen Albritton. If someone offered me that job because I'm a woman, I'd say, shoot me again, please, to be doubly sure I'm dead.
Someone should check on this woman. Okay.
Third line, please kill me now. That's what it says. But it's like, if you've already been shot, you can't ask to be shot again.
She said to be doubly sure that she's dead. Read, Tom.
I'm sorry. I'm not good at reading. I wish I was as good at reading as Janet is at writing. Sam Mostyn is an exceptional leader who represents the best of Bond Australia, Anthony Albanese said when announcing a new role. Each to their own. I'd tweak that slightly to read, Mostyn reflects the worst of modern woke Australia. So a bit of a tweak there.
Just slightly. Just a slight tweak. Yeah. Tracked edit, you know, track change.
Andrew Bolt, stay true to form with an absolute horrific piece of work here. Sam Mostyn sure has made affirmative action work for her. Demanding women get jobs ahead of men means she's now our next Governor General.
They're taking over. That's why, yeah, they're taking over.
God damn it. I mean, yeah, anyway. We don't have time. Pauline Hanson had the best take of all, of course, as always. This appointment that's been given by the Labor Party, I just don't think it's in Australia's best interest, she said.
Go on.
Well,
do the voice.
That's racist. You know what? Probably.
I'm not known for my voices.
Second thoughts, don't.
You know, probably what we could possibly put forward is, instead of political parties picking their mates, jobs for their mates, let's look at the Australian people at the election. Why don't we put a few names up, let the Australian people nominate who they want as Governor General? Let it go on the ballot paper at the time of election. Don't have a separate ballot for it. And let the Australian people choose who they want to see as the Governor General.
Welcome to the resistance. Comrade Pauline.
Just a reminder, Pauline spoke at the Australians for Constitutional Monarchy conference in 2022.
Right. Okay. I was going to ask. No. Okay.
It's almost like she doesn't know things.
That couldn't be it.
Anyway, best of luck to Sam and everyone involved. And who gives a shit? Another story that took the headlines here. Now, we need to be careful here in case we're breaking any Greens rules.
Get in trouble.
But this week, Victorian Greens leader Samantha Ratnam has announced that she's running for pre-selection in the Labor-held seat of Wills.
No comment.
I will not comment on those woos. If anyone doesn't know, the rules of Victorian Greens mean that, because I'm the membership officer for my local Greens branch.
Am I allowed to say things?
You can say whatever the hell you want, baby.
I don't know. I'm scared. I'm scared.
And I'm generally not commenting on the quality of either of these candidates or telling any members how to vote. We're just talking about stuff that's in the public domain, which is the fact that there is going to be a contested run for the nomination for the seat of Wills. And it's an interesting one. This is the seat currently held by Peter Khalil, friend of the show, on a margin of 8.6%. In 2022, Sarah Jefford was our candidate. She got a 2% swing towards the Greens for a primary vote of 28%. Sarah has also announced she's going to be running for the pre-selection. So we've got Samantha and Sarah running for the nomination, which I think is a good thing in general. The fact
contested election. Yeah. I love it. It's exciting. Yes. Yeah. Let's actually do more of those.
Ratnam, of course, is the leader of the Victorian Greens. If she's endorsed, if she wins, she would also have to step down as leader of the party in Victoria. And she would have to resign from Parliament altogether when she formally nominates as a candidate 2 weeks after an election is called. So it's, you know, her moving as the leader of the Greens in the state parliament and potentially having a tilt at a federal seat.
Yes. And so then would there have to be a by? No. How does it work with the Legislative Council?
No, in the upper house, there would be sort of the next on the
ticket. Oh, just a pick from the next. Who's the next on the ticket?
No idea.
Does anyone know? No. Oh, it's a casual vacancy. And you'd nominate someone and the members would get to choose. Thank you.
Fuck, I love our audience. Okay. Give us a cheer if you work for the Greens.
They all hesitantly, they're like,
are we allowed to say? Okay.
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
You seem fun.
No, I'm better. You are fun. And I appreciate you. Were very helpful. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay.
But the Greens' chances in Wills is very interesting, right? I mean, Adam Bant put out a statement saying 1 in 10 voters had to change their vote in order for the Greens to win, and 40% of the electorate are renters. And as long as I've been sort of paying attention, people are saying Wills is the next Victorian seat to go, right?
I'm interested to hear this because to me it sounds like a really tall order. Like looking at the numbers, you have to take, you know, at least I guess a 5 or 6% swing straight off Labor.
Yep.
And then count on getting enough LNP preferences if they come in third because it's Labor, Greens, and then Liberal, sorry.
You
people. But yeah, that's a pretty tall order. But I mean, it sounds as though on the ground and from what we're hearing from Labor people that they are shit scared and think that it is a good chance of falling to the Greens.
Hell yeah, baby. Well, there's a redistribution which might, you know, throw things either way. Okay. There is a redistribution that could work out that would be in Labor's favor and one in our favor. So that's still a little bit TBC. But especially over the issue of Labor's disgraceful position on Gaza. And Peter Khalil has certainly, shame indeed, has been held to the fire over this. This is from Adam. Peter Khalil and Labor have failed renters, failed people who were trying to buy their first home, and failed to condemn the state of Israel's invasion of Gaza. The people of Wills are progressive and compassionate, but their values are being betrayed by a Labor Party approving new coal and gas projects and backing the invasion of Gaza while ignoring renters and offering band-aid solutions to the cost of living crisis. The people of Wills can send Labor a message without helping Peter Dutton. Fuck yes! And I'll tell you who's worried. Labor, on hearing of Ratnam's candidacy, a senior Victorian Labor figure said, bye-bye, Peter.
Bye-bye, Peter. Bye-bye.
Who are these sources?
I know.
Why would you go to the media?
And a journalist going, do you have any comment on that? And they say, Bye bye, Peter.
Peter Khalil. If things don't change or the seat doesn't change in the upcoming redistribution, we're in huge trouble, they said. Labour figures said there was a misconception among the party that Muslim voters who have traditionally voted Labour would continue to do so out of concern the Greens were too socially progressive. Jesus Christ. The Muslim community are feeling really hurt and disappointed by Labour, and it's not enough for us to counter it with the Greens are too radical. You can't vote for them. Oh, you figured that out, have you?
Almost.
There is an impression among this group that the Greens are the only ones sticking up for them at the moment, because we are.
An impression. Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. We need to do more to stick up for them or to change the impression?
I think to change the impression, Tom. Don't get crazy.
I see. Yeah, that's that. Incremental change. And look, I just found this story. Now, I cannot validate this story. This is from a Twitter account called @geesemegamix. So I have no idea the veracity of this. But they tweet, since Peter Khalil is in the news, please know that a few weeks ago he was spotted at a local pub, so a few dozen anti-genocide activists turned up. Brave Peter asked for the bar staff to call the cops, which they pretended to do.
Yes, yes.
And he sat back down to get yelled at some more. A full 45 minutes getting sprayed for being a cowardly shit cunt while you wait for a police escort that no one liked you enough to actually call for in the first place. Glorious. Best of luck in the election, Peter. There we go. Now, what do we got to do? Surprise, surprise, we're already running late. Should we bring up, what do you think?
Do you want to do a quick, bring out Oz and do a quick profile or?
You want us with the profile? Just talk amongst yourself, guys. I'm sorry. Well, we've got, what have we, just do it quick? Okay, quick. All right, sweet. No worries. All right, tell the good people.
It's just that Tom promised me something really exciting, so I don't want to skip it. This is personal for me because last time we were here, we profiled an amazing, Victorian in Ralph Babbitt. I don't know if anyone else was here and remembers that. It was very good. And Tom promised me that he would introduce me to more of, your culture and your people to try and win me over. And so I understand that I was going to learn about the man, the myth, the legend, Jim Penman.
Jim goddamn Penman. Any fans
That's
in?
Unfortunately, we couldn't get Jim to join us for the show today, so we have another guest we would like to now welcome
who
to the
fucks
stage.
Like nobody's business.
Yes, that's right. Heaps of sex, and not just for children. Our guest is the culture editor for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. He is the host of The Drop podcast and, most importantly, the son of a Green senator. Please welcome Oz Faruqi. Oh, that's, wow.
Hey,
thanks,
Oz.
Thanks for squeezing me in between the gym fucking two.
I'm sorry.
That went on for so long.
Wow. I spent my entire morning researching that motherfucker, masturbating furiously.
Nah, it was funny. It was funny. It was good.
Now, thanks for coming back, actually, Oz, because you were our first ever guest, little known fact.
Yes.
It's actually funny. So I did the pilot episode of this podcast with you guys, and it never went to air.
The
so I assumed
episode.
That this podcast didn't exist. And then you're like, we're doing a live event. I'm like, that's cool. And you're like, it's sold out. I'm like, oh, I guess it did exist. And people enjoy listening
to
it.
We had to wait
cool.
until we were ready for you, Oz,
You were so good.
We had to grow up. Yeah.
What are we were talking about?
We were talking about COVID and
the
weather.
Protest, the tradie protest.
Yeah.
Right?
Jesus. Yeah. That was a thing. They were singing that song on the bridge.
Yes, they were singing the song and we were all like, what are we doing? And then we kind of forgot about it.
Now we're back.
Let's not go back to that.
Those days. Now, you have obviously a familial connection to the Greens, but you also were a candidate at some point, right? You were involved with the party in student politics, have I got that right?
This is embarrassing to talk about. Sort of was involved in student politics, don't ever say that to anyone else, and got involved. I worked for a few different Greens MPs in New South Wales, which was a lot of fun. I learned a lot about politics in the world. And, I don't know how many people here are vaguely involved with the Greens or minor party stuff, but there's all these seats the Greens need to run in, and they just need someone to run, even if they don't think they're going to win. So I put my hand up when I was 23 or 24 to run for one of those seats. I did okay. I got 21%.
Whoa!
Oh, that's pretty good.
Which was a 4% swing on the previous candidate. Do you know who that was?
Who?
My mum. Yeah. Take that.
Wow.
Take that.
Get fucking owned, mum.
You fucking nepo baby.
Yeah.
But within the Greens, so very little advantage.
Yeah, obviously she went on to do her thing. So
she's all right.
She did okay.
What seat was that? So that was seat?
Yeah, the seat is called Heffron. It's in Sydney. It's sort of like inner city-ish, but like half of it is people like us and half of it is like conservative Bengalis who did not like me because I'm Pakistani. Or at least that was the excuse I gave.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally, totally tanking in those suburbs.
Mm.
And what? And briefly, we'll move on to, we've got some two big stories we really want to touch on with you. But I mean, you know, you are. I always enjoyed reading your political analysis, and I think you're someone who, you know, appreciates the Greens as a party and the kind of movement and the force that we're about. But you're also willing to critique it and see that its shortcomings. And I guess, how would you sum up your take on where the Greens are these days?
Good question.
Thank you so much.
I mean, I left working in politics because I just had done that for a lot and wanted to do other things that wasn't out of a sort of sense of the Greens are terrible and I want them to fall apart and I'm going to join the Labour Party or anything. I think what I've tried to do with political analysis since then, and I think it's interesting you guys are doing a similar thing. There is such little media even now, and certainly 10 years ago when I started writing about these things, that looked at a party like the Greens or that sort of left space in politics and took it seriously for what it was trying to do and understood why people were attracted to it, why people perhaps were not attracted to it, and what was actually happening. Like what drove the Greens to make certain decisions? Why were they winning certain seats and losing other seats? And I think having had that firsthand experience, knowing those people, being involved in campaigns, gave me the capacity to talk about that from some actual place of experience. Largely, you know, my politics are probably not a surprise to people. They align more closely with the Greens than other parties. But I've got criticisms of both some of their policies and the way I think they approach political machinations in Canberra.
Yeah.
But you must have noticed a big change between the time when you were running again as a candidate. So that's what, more than a decade ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. And this new revival in Greensland, a more social, democratic socialist.
I mean, it feels, from a lot of the things that I was critical of the party of when I was leaving, they're the things that I guess a new generation of activists have pushed the party to be more like. I think, you know, if you look up just stuff that I read between 2012 and 2016, when I was more engaged in writing about that sort of stuff, it was critical of the Greens for adopting what I thought was a very clear attempt to position themselves as a moderate party.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced that that led to electoral dividend in that sort of 2013 to 2016 period. Mm-hmm. I think the party since then has figured out a clearer strategy of who it's trying to appeal to, differentiating itself from Labour, from the left. And I think that might seem obvious to a lot of people, but there was a period for a long time where party leadership was trying to say, we're not crazy, we're not radical, we're not trying to shake things up. You can trust us to just be like the other guys, but a little bit nicer to refugees. And I wasn't convinced that that was a good strategy to either grow the vote or to change the country.
Now we're crazy as hell.
And it seems to be working out.
Yeah. Almost as though we needed to, like, it was like it, what needed to happen was an expansion beyond just green issues, right? But that didn't necessarily need to happen in a moderate way. It was like we needed to expand into economic issues and, you know, social issues and whatnot, but then take a radical approach to that.
And I think maybe some of the battles when I was very involved in internal party stuff was the left-wing economic policies that the Greens did have were getting ameliorated. There was very clear attempts eradicate policies that I think now the Greens have embraced that are finding electoral dividend.
Yeah, particularly around taxing the rich.
Absolutely.
I would say is something the Greens have made huge progress on, actually embracing and not being afraid to say, yeah, we want to fuck those fuckers over because that's what they're doing to us. So speaking of fucking people over.
Yes.
We wanted to talk about the migration bill that was, because we kind of touched on this briefly on the show and said we would come back to it. This is the bill that Labor introduced super last minute, maybe a few weeks ago. It's been referred to a Senate committee for a 6-week inquiry. It's the Migration Removal and Other Measures Bill.
Yeah, other measures doing a lot of work.
Other measures, leans heavily on that. Can you give us what's your understanding of the key things that the bill does for anyone who's missed it? And I found there's a few parts to it, so.
You're stitching me up on this because beforehand I was like, I don't know if I'm an expert on this bill, but I'll give it a red hot go. I mean, I think the important thing to acknowledge about it straight up is that the genesis of this bill is very simply in the fact that the Labor Party in government is freaking out about a series of media stories that relate to refugees who have been released from detention, who may be committing crimes or have a criminal past. There's a complicated thing I would love to chat to you guys about the media's complicity in like driving these sorts of policies as well, but we can maybe park that for the moment. But essentially there's a high court case that the government lost that said a whole bunch of people who were locked up and had criminal convictions could now go back in the community.
indefinite detention was bad.
Correct.
You cannot keep people locked up forever.
Exactly.
Which is apparently Labor's fucking policy too. That indefinite policy.
I mean, this is the High Court, right? Which is not a radical leftist institution that has said this one went too far. You guys fucked it. These people are allowed to live in the community. Mm. But obviously, Australia being the kind of country that it is, every single time one of these people who's released is accused of doing anything bad, the media and the coalition say this is because Labor does not have a handle on immigration policy. So they've rushed this bill, which is an attempt to try to put as much of these people back in prison, to try and stop another round of people who are still being detained, including, I think, the one case is an Iranian asylum seeker who is bisexual and is saying they can't go back to Iran because they could be executed. Mm. This bill's genesis is trying to stop that person from getting asylum in Australia. And it has a whole raft of other measures as well, including things like if you haven't demonstrated the fact that you've worked with the government of the country you're in, you're not going to get asylum in Australia. So imagine that. Mm. Imagine telling Afghan refugees that until they can prove they sat down with the Taliban and tried to work things out, they're not going to get refugee status in Australia.
Yeah. So, I believe in consensus decision making.
Yeah, you know.
And I think if you can listen, you know, hear people out and see where people are coming from.
Well, that's really nice of you to say, Tom. So this is where I get a little bit confused, right? Because we had this High Court decision around indefinite detention being illegal, and that resulted in the release. And the Labor government responded by introducing these laws that would impose really strict conditions. We did an episode on this back in, I think, November, imposing really strict conditions on them, like curfews and things like that, and locking them up if they break those strict conditions. This is somewhat separate in that it relates to the court case of the Iranian man is where Iran doesn't accept return of people on an involuntary basis. And because he is refusing to facilitate his return, that's involuntary. But what the government's trying to do is change the law so that they have to force him to comply, and then they can say that's voluntary, force him to facilitate his own deportation.
With the threat of a year in prison, right? Like, make that a criminal offence for him to not cooperate.
Yeah.
So that they hold that threat over that person, and then suddenly he's voluntarily working.
Voluntary, yeah, that's right. And so then they can say, well, Iran, this is voluntary, so you have to take him back. So that's and that's where I get confused, because I understand that people are saying, yeah, there is a link between this quote unquote threat of community safety. So is it because if this High Court case is successful, people like this man would be released into the community and there's a fear of driving up fear around that?
Yeah, I think the link is just that it's a response to what the media and political narrative will be. It's not a reaction to any genuine concern. No. We're not talking about, not that obviously this is a line that I agree with, we're not talking about tens of thousands of people flooding Australia or whatever. This is purely a response to a media narrative that has developed since that initial High Court case that suggests that Labor's lost control of the borders and Labor now is desperately trying to figure out how it can outflank the coalition by proving that, yeah, you know what, one thing we've never done in Australia, even under the worst of the Howard years, was send people deliberately back to countries where we knew that they could get killed.
Yes.
We are now passing laws to make that happen, to facilitate that, essentially.
Jesus Christ. And then there's talk too of this, you know, the word Trump is being thrown around a lot, you know, bring up big memories of the Muslim ban when Trump took office. This idea that we would list certain countries and say that we aren't issuing any visas from people from this country because when people do come, they overstay their visas. Sometimes they claim asylum or they just stay in the country. Now, my understanding is that the government wouldn't actually use that power, but they would use it as a incentive to get those countries to cooperate with them returning and refouling people from here.
I mean, I think it's interesting you mentioned Trump. Like, the thing about Trump in Australian context that I find fundamentally depressing is that most people would hear about Trump's Muslim ban and they say, that's fucking crazy. Like, that's outrageous. What a crazy poll. The thing that always sticks out with me is that infamous phone call between Malcolm Turnbull and Donald Trump, I think 2016, 2017, when they were trying to negotiate the people swap. And Malcolm Turnbull was explaining to Donald Trump how then immigration policy worked, which then was like less cooked than it is now, but was largely the result of the Gillard and Rudd policies and then the Operation Sovereign Border stuff that Labor supported. And when Trump heard that, this is after he'd gotten elected on the platform of Muslim, and he said, wow, you guys are even worse than I am. And I think that's a thing that a lot of Australians don't really want to acknowledge. They're like, no. I know we're pretty bad, but Trump's worse. So thank God we're not quite at Trump level. Mm. Trump's literally, he's not metaphorically, he's going to say, you guys are fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't get away with that stuff.
Because he was saying, what, these are criminals and bad people. And Turnbull had to be like, no, they've committed no crime
exactly,
whatsoever.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. And they were never settled in Australia. That's the issue we've got here. So they have to go to America. We can't do anything about them.
Mm. Fuck that guy! Love being reminded of how terrible these people are.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Labor saying, oh, my God, Peter Dutton and Adam Band teaming up once again. The Noalition to send this thing off to an inquiry to waylay it, right? They're trying to defend it. And they are, as you mentioned there, seriously trying to outflank the coalition to the right on these issues of immigration. We had Claire O'Neill, I think.
Always a good idea. Every time Labor does this, try and out coalition the coalition. Always works out well for them.
Peter Dutton, you think you're Peter Dutton?
Yeah.
Watch this.
Yeah. I
mean, that is literally what Claire said, basically. She's like, Claire, this is the Home Affairs Minister. She said something like, Peter Dutton said that he was tough on refugees. He's never passed a bill as tough as this. So again, there's no subtext anymore. Labor's not trying to pretend we are doing this to save people. We're doing this to stop deaths at sea or whatever the line used to be. They're just openly now arguing that we are really, really tough. We're tougher than Dutton. That's their strategy.
Right.
Unclear if it makes much sense.
And then being like,
very clear.
Why are we losing votes to the Greens?
And then they're like, oh, Peter Khalil's in trouble. I wonder why.
Yeah.
Why does the Muslim community not have fans
of
us?
We just need to explain more. Yeah, we need to explain more to the voters so they understand how much, why we hate refugees and we need to lock them all up.
So galling too, because there were Labor hacks saying after the Dunkley by-election, see, your politics of division and hatred doesn't work. See, it's not a vote winner. And then they turn around and do this shit.
It's a really interesting one. Like, I think people on the left of politics generally, the view of Labor is, they are sometimes forced to act to the right of the coalition to try and stop that vote, you know, bleeding to. I guess I'm playing devil's advocate.
Are they forced?
Yeah. No, I'm from the perspective of your average Labor hack, right? They're kind of like, we have to do this stuff, otherwise we could never win government. When you look at the history of both immigration policy and the history of elections, there's actually very little evidence for that.
Yeah.
The mandatory detention was introduced in Australia, not by John Howard, by Paul Keating. Mm-hmm. Like, Labor went out and did that. And even though, obviously, the coalition have their own terrible record on immigration policy when it comes to the treatment of asylum seekers, Rudd and Gillard, 2012, 2013, were worse, let's say worse, were more extreme on saying that no one who comes by boat will ever settle in Australia. Mm,
yeah.
That's not something John Howard ever did, right? Yeah. So it's not like Labor's always being begrudgingly dragged to the coalition position.
No.
They're doing it whilst they're in government. And the other weird thing is, the last time Labor had an emphatic electoral victory was 2007, right? 2010 was a hung parliament. The last election, record low primary vote for a party to win government. In 2007, the Labor Party's immigration policy was, we're going to smash the Pacific solution.
Mm.
We're going to get rid of offshore detention and we're going to bring more people in. And they won. And I'm not trying to say that they won because millions of Australians went on the streets and voted for that.
No.
But the point is, when Labor people say, we have to do this right-wing stuff to win elections, the evidence is not really there for it.
Mm. Particularly when, you know, we should acknowledge in this term of government, with there was the, you know, the abolition of TPVs. Like, Labor has done some stuff and have given some people who are in a sort of bridge of visa purgatory a more security and a greater path to living here securely. So they can do stuff and will make huge noise about it whenever they do something that isn't horrific and evil towards refugees, because it's the right thing to do. And then we'll turn around again with this kind of insane.
And yeah, I mean, I don't know. What do you guys think it will? It doesn't, from a political perspective, I don't understand who they think they're going for.
Yeah.
Like, who the voter is who's like, oh, Labor, like, I guess I'm going to vote for Labor now because they're more right wing than Dutton. I don't understand that person.
They're like, my number one issue is how much you lock up refugees. And so I'm going to
vote for Albanese.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, I don't know. Like, if they're that far gone, then they're not fucking voting for you
exactly.
on that basis.
Yeah, they're voting on the emotion or the idea of Dutton is the hardline guy.
Which,
yeah.
again, like, brings us back to, you know, what the actual solution that, you know, Labor, if they were smart, would look at is, what are those people actually going to vote on? And generally what people vote on is the issues that affect them in their own lives. And the issue is that they are sold the lie that, you know, refugees and migrants in general are the reason that they can't afford to pay the rent, or maybe that they feel unsafe in their community or whatever, when that's probably the fucking media. And, you know, the housing crisis obviously isn't caused primarily by migration. Mm. But yeah, instead of going, how can we pursue a universalist politics that looks at what unites us rather than divides us and delivers gains for ordinary people on a broad basis. They're like, what's the LNP doing? Yeah. Maybe we can do that
They're
harder.
Yelling about us in Parliament, everyone watches.
They're going to do mean ads on Facebook, so we have to do this.
Fucking wild.
I think that's right, yeah. And I think the other thing is that there are so few spaces left where government is like the predominant force in deciding outcomes, like whether it's healthcare, education, housing, welfare, whatever, everything has been abandoned to the market,
outsourced,
right?
Yeah.
Except for like immigration policy or at least asylum policy.
Everything except the cops.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So that's like the last cops remaining ground where major parties can actually say, this is our policy vision, because everything else, it's like, well, the issue is just like housing supply. That's the issue for developers to figure
market.
Out.
Market. Yeah.
Maybe one last bit on this before we move on to the other story we want to talk to you about. But I suppose maybe circling back to what you mentioned about the media, I mean, what is galling about this debate, it seems, is that even when the horrific lie is exposed, it doesn't change the conversation. So ahead of the Dunkley by-election, we had this racist bullshit about how one of these released refugees or people seeking asylum were supposedly arrested for a crime. The crime slips my mind at the moment. Was it
an alleged assault.
An alleged assault, right. Yeah. Alleged assault. Turns out that they arrested the wrong guy.
Whoops.
Whoopsie-daisy.
Yep.
Completely wrong. He was in the area, though, and had brown skin. So, you know, that's a crime. We find that out. That's absolutely bullshit. And it doesn't change the conversation one dot, it seems like. Everyone's just like, oh, well, Dantin's on Insiders that weekend going, no, we don't regret anything.
Yeah.
That incident actually shows the threat that we're talking about. Like,
there's two bits to this that drove me totally crazy, right? One is that the police literally said, I can't believe they said this out loud. They said, we got the guys, like, he was the same race, but we got the wrong guy. I'm like,
so close.
That's what we
so
accuse.
So close.
That's, we like, say that on. You're racially profiling, and they're like, we don't racially profile. They're literally like, he was the same kind of brown, 6 to 7 p.m., and there was another guy, and we rest. And I just think, even in the States, which obviously has a deeply cooked policing culture as well, I just can't imagine a police chief getting up and saying that and getting away with it.
And then
obviously there's.
In our defense, close enough.
And the other bit of that is frustrating is that the way that the police operate so hand in glove with lots of the media, honestly, where they make that arrest before charges have laid, before there's anything in court, there's brief outlets about
fucking
it.
Hell. Mm-hmm.
And the Dutton line is in there. And like, this is the other thing. Peter Dutton ran the Department of Home Affairs for a very long time. He knows where the bodies are buried. When you read a series of stories after that high court case, and it was like the 102 asylum seekers that are jailed for rapes and murders, like, where do you think that came from, right?
Yeah.
This is a very cozy relationship by police, politicians, senior public officials, sections of the media to construct a narrative.
And there's a correct, you know, there'll be a correction, but it never goes as far.
Totally.
The damage is already done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, moving on. I forget that we don't solve anything on this podcast, but it's good to get the context. It's really important that we talk about that story because we didn't get a chance as yet. So thank you for that, Oz. The other thing we want to talk about is sort of more in your culture portfolio. Mm. You host a fantastic podcast called The Drop, which people should definitely check out, talking about the weekly politics. Far less depressing than our podcast. It's been talking about culture and stuff. But, of course, a massive cultural story over the past couple of weeks has been what the fuck is going on with the live music scene in this country with the cancellations.
The cancellation? Oh, yes.
Cancellation. That's my new term. The cancellation of Splendor in the Grass. What happened there? Do we actually know why Splendor in the Grass was happening? It was because of
And Falls and Dark Mofo, Paws and Groove in the Moo. Like,
they're all in trouble, hey?
Yeah, I think they all got cancelled, right?
Yeah, we can talk about Splendor for a second and then we can talk about like the systemic
generally,
issues, I guess.
Yeah.
Splendor, like the goss on that is that they just did not sell tickets.
Yeah.
Unexpected events.
There's that's
I
what
guess
they
if
said,
you're expecting to sell tickets.
They said... They said publicly, Splendor's capacity these days is like 48,000 people. And you're hoping if you're running a festival of that size, when tickets go on sale, you want to sell at least half of those tickets. That's that's like back in the olden
like
days.
Like within
Tom,
days.
Within the first day.
First day.
Like, Tom, when you were at Triple J, right, you would announce a Splendor lineup and that would sell in like half an hour.
So it's because they don't have
that's the issue.
On
they don't
Triple
have Tom
J anymore. Yeah. Okay, sold.
I agree.
But, you know, obviously since then things have changed a bit. And so Splendor's had to recalibrate and they still would expect to be selling half their tickets on day one. I'm told that they sold less than 10% of the tickets in the 2 weeks since they went on sale.
Not everyone can sell out their shows, you know.
We are the Kylie Minogue of leftist podcasting.
And I guess the question then is like, okay, why didn't they do that? And that raises a whole bunch of interesting questions about what is happening in Australian society, what is happening to how younger people want to consume and engage in art and culture, and what is happening at a, this is a boring word to use, but like a meta structural level with the Australian music industry.
Oh, that
is
cancelization.
You're here. This is where we talk about.
We can talk about structure?
Yeah, we
great,
can.
Great,
yes.
Great, great.
Because I saw you posting on social media, there's a little bit of a, you know, juicy capitalist analysis or anti-capitalist analysis rather about the actual business and the market, the political economy of music festivals.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking, I mean, all these things are a little bit different. So Dark Mofo, you mentioned, sorry, Mona Foma, which is the one that cancelled yesterday. That's Dave Walsh, the guy who runs Mona, his thing. That cancelled, that's sad. I feel like that's sort of in a slightly different category because that's just a crazy billionaire doing his thing.
Yeah.
I feel like the issue there was Brian Ritchie, who is one of the guys from the Violent Femmes, which is a band old people know. He programmed that festival every year for 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's not that surprising if you're looking at who is the market for going to Tasmania to go to a music festival. A guy who is of that vintage programming, maybe it's great for him and his friends, but it's probably not the right kind of lineup to get younger people who want to spend money to go. So that's, I think that's like the Mona Foma boring thing. The other thing with Splendor, I don't know how many people know about this, but Splendor, the company that runs it, a company called Secret Sounds, the majority of it is now owned by a US company called Live Nation. It's the biggest, yeah. If you have any interest in
they
music
own
stuff,
all they, of it. They own all the music.
Ticket tech, they own venues all around this country. They
also do comedy touring, and I think they're a fantastic organization.
Right.
And they own the Palais Theatre. Please let me go back.
I mean, this stuff is impacting comedy. I don't want to put Tom on blast too much, but you know, there is a certain company starting with T that basically runs and owns everything to do with comedy in this country.
Ooh.
But I'll just finish the Splendor thing, I guess. And that company, in turn, Live Nation, its third biggest shareholder is the Saudi Arabian government public investment fund. So when you think about how...
Hey, they love live music.
When you think about the fact that like these festivals like Falls, Spilt Milk, Live Nation, Splendor are supposed to be or started as organic, vaguely organic spaces where people could afford to go, have a nice time, see bands they like, have a great experience. Over years, as the main decision makers behind that become shareholders many, many, many layers removed, obviously the incentive is how do we extract as much revenue from punters as possible and how do we deliver the cheapest possible experience? And that, I think, has come to a head in the last couple of years where there was obviously the flooded year of Splendor in 2022. Yeah. I was there reporting from that. But you could say that, sure, who could predict the weather? The council predicted the weather. They told Splendor, you need to like get extra space, you need to get extra buses, and Splendor just didn't do it. The following year after that, no rain, not enough buses to get people on. So this is like that term, the enchidification of everything. This is like happening in live music as well, where almost everything at a medium to large scale, venues, booking, promotions, labels, festivals, is run by people who have no interest in the art, the craft, the enjoyment, and every interest in extracting as much money as possible. Obviously, people have a bad time and they're like, why the fuck would I pay $800 on tickets, flights, and food to experience that when I can stay at home, come to a nice show like this, or see Taylor Swift or Fred again or whatever. Like,
but
that.
That's my question, right? Because like, yeah, Taylor Swift, Fred again, those massive kind of stadium shows that are still, that's under Live Nation, right? Like I know at least the Taylor Swift shows and they sell the fuck out and they're very expensive. Why is it that people are wanting that experience and spending all their money there and not on festivals?
It's a really good question. I think there are two maybe kind of contradictory things because I don't totally know the answer myself. Like I've been grappling with this. I think the most obvious one is Taylor Swift and then like Fred again are like the biggest artists on the planet, right? So you could argue that, well, they're always going to do okay because they're in this other tier. Basically, no one else can match that. But then I think, okay, that's an easy way to just deflect it, but there probably is something more interesting. I think what it suggests to me is whilst cost of living is certainly an issue that is probably impacting festivals, young people spending more money on rent and, you know, wage increases, dog shit, all that sort of stuff. So if you've got a limited amount of resources, are you going to spend it on the act that you really care about that is around the corner from where you live? You can have a nice time. You can control all those bits. Or you're going to take a risk on a festival experience that the last couple of times has been pretty negative. And so I think the money then diverts from the festival experience and it goes to Taylor Swift and Fred again. The question then is, why does that matter? Who cares? I think it matters in a couple of ways. I feel like, Tom, you've played Splendor before. Like you've done your comedy things there.
Done your little jokes.
Yeah, little jokes.
I've told the truth, yes. And I've changed people's lives.
3 stars.
Yes. Yeah. 3 stars.
Hey, fuck off.
Sit down.
Actually, while you're here, talk to your mates. I was going to say,
when that review, I heard Tom talking about that review. When that review came in, it's looked after by a wonderful arts editor. And she's like, oh, Tom's like your friend. Like, what do you think? And I was like, I actually had the same thought. I was like, what? This review doesn't seem
consistent.
Yeah. But I guess this demonstrates how unbiased I am.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't going to go in and like change the stars.
You wouldn't fucking read about it.
That's been Oz Faruqi. Very nice to have you.
You're doing fine. You're doing fine, are you?
Yeah, I'm doing
fine. Well, it's the bit about Splendor I was going to say. Sorry. Is that the what Splendor was so important for from a perspective I think we should care about is so many Australian acts, the thing used to be for 15 years, that even if you weren't high profile, you could go to Splendor, there'd be 25, 30, 35,000 people at that festival. They'd see you play because it was 3 p.m. There wasn't much else on. And then that would secure your career for the next couple of years. Mm. You could then tour up and down, you know, the East Coast at playing venues. People would buy your records. That was part of an ecosystem that helped create and nurture a generation of Australian artists telling Australian stories and like feeding back into that local scene. The loss of festivals, the loss of the hegemony of things like Triple J, the fact that the way that we mainly consume music now is through Spotify and YouTube, who have algorithms not designed to support Australian music, but designed to just funnel you into the same number of acts and keep you on the app for as long as possible. Mm. The fact that like young people can't afford to live in cities and that venues are turning into apartments and no one can play there. All these things, I think, are combining to make it very, very worrying for Australian music, I think, for the future.
Well, I mean, one more thing that I think is interesting when you talk about the way that Spotify and the algorithms work, one of the takes around why these sorts of festivals are failing is because people are moving towards more like getting more and more stuck into a particular niche. And I mean, a lot of young people get their music from TikTok and from these really kind of narrowly defined algorithms. And so festivals like particular genre festivals are doing really well. And is that a result of, this kind of siloing due to the algorithm? Is that a problem?
I think that's spot on. I think that is happening. I don't think that's bad. I think, some festivals are adapting and being like, this is the vibe, come here for that. I think maybe what happened is we'll look back and be like, that kind of big day out to Splendor era of the mass festival for everyone maybe was an anomaly. And maybe it was supported by the fact that, like, largely Triple J had this chokehold. Right. On like people aged 16 to 25. And if they said, listen to this, buy this
ticket, give it a crack.
People did.
Yeah.
And I think that has dissipated. I think you're right. I think it's good for those festivals that are genre specific. I remain concerned specifically about the ability that Australian artists can, the channels for them to come through and make enough money to succeed in this current moment.
Yeah.
Do you briefly want to talk about your take about how you hate music festivals generally?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess from my perspective, this is the thing. Like, I grew up in Byron, and so my experience of music festivals is a bunch of people like coming in and jamming the phone network and traffic being really shitty.
Putting money into the local economy.
Barely.
You and your friends employed.
Stealing your hacky sex.
I guess there is an argument. Like, is the argument for supporting music festivals? And I know that, the Greens came out and proposed this festival support package with, says that the federal government should be doing grants. They should be underwriting insurance, particularly in light of, the climate crisis, making that more difficult. This kind of crisis package. But I'm like, what is the social benefit of festivals? Is it just jobs and, money into local economies? If so, sure.
I mean,
Emerald does not take drugs.
My experience, all of that and around. Just so bust.
Yeah, the social context is not sharing, taking pingers and making out with a bunch of randoms.
Should have led with
the
social benefit. Sorry.
It's a really valid point. It's like, at the end of the day, like, who cares? If people can still go to big shows and enjoy themselves, what does it really matter? I guess jobs is part of it. But one of the things I found a little bit, not annoying, but short-sighted from the Greens announcement and from what the government's, and they've called this review, calling for submissions into looking at what's happening live music. And it's all like, how do we give these people grants? How do we waive insurance? I'm like, I know this is a boring thing to talk about, but giving subsidies to the Saudi Arabian-owned Live Nation company
does not
seem like the best way to support a healthy... That company, Live Nation, posted a $23 billion revenue statement last year. They do not need taxpayer dollars from Australia. And I think the government has a big role to play in supporting Australian music, whether that's through, when talking about insurance, I'm sure people are familiar with like venues like the Old Bar here or, you know, the Nightcap, whatever. Insurance premiums, public liability has gone from $90,000 to $300,000 in 12 months. That kind of money being used to make sure that those venues can exist feels like a way better use of funds. And I don't want to pick and choose. Like, I've had a good time at festivals. I'm a bit too old for them now. But if some people want to go to grungy pubs in Melbourne and discover music that way, awesome. If it takes you being dragged by your friends to go to Splendor or Falls or whatever to discover music, that's also good. But I'm less worried about the long-term impact of losing Splendor.
Yeah.
I'm more worried about the long-term impact of just there not being any live music venues left in cities like Melbourne and Sydney.
Yeah.
Under socialism, we will have publicly owned music
festivals
for all.
Yes. Yeah, all right. I'll go to one of those.
Totally, yeah.
Another problem solved. Give it up for the Wadul Osman Faruqi, everybody. Thanks for being here, man.
Well,
thank
you. Sure. Questions.
We've
got like 5 minutes of questions.
Yeah.
Good.
Awesome.
Thanks for being here, man. Thank you for coming back after your
120 episodes later. Make it to air.
But this one is only for the subscribers?
No.
Okay. The Jim Penman thing was...
you guys are paying for the Jim Penman stuff?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Right. You guys are crazy.
He's commodified
everything.
We didn't
get to the eugenics stuff. It's really funny.
Jesus.
You'll see. You'll all see. We got just 5 minutes left and we don't want to run over because there is a another show after us in this venue, but we want to throw it open. If there are any quick questions for us or for any of us at all about anything in the world, anything we've talked about now or any other subjects that you wanted out there, if you want to have a really quick think about that and just yell them out, we'll try and get through them.
That's a fucking great idea. I mean, we're talking about you were joking about like publicly owned music. Triple J used to put on a music festival, put on multiple.
Yeah.
Like,
what do we do about that?
We
literally,
I guess that is.
So many
of
these things is we literally had them, and then either through like funding cuts or just like the right people, you know, moving on and doing other things, we didn't have them anymore. We had, and with radio and TV as well, like we had publicly funded institutions that pushed Australian music in front of us, and then we gave them a space to play as well. Like, why isn't, like, fucking Greens, talk about that, you know?
Yeah,
like,
well, can you talk to your mum?
Bring that back.
You do it. Call your mother.
Talk to your mummy, loser.
All right, any other questions? Raise your hand real quick. We'll try and get through them. Anybody about anything at all?
Well, we've answered everything.
Jesus Christ. I guess we really fixed everything.
It's really good. Right.
What do you think is going to happen in the next election?
Oh, hang on. Did someone have one?
Oh, we have one?
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry, I'm sorry. I can't actually see your arms.
Oh, yeah.
I apologize.
Job ideas for Peter Khalil.
I hope he doesn't get a job and us live on JobSeeker. And I think he'll be pleasantly surprised.
I mean, I think the next election will be fascinating, though, because we tend to see this pattern with, like, the 2010, right? The last time that there was an election immediately following the election of a Labor government, 2010, the Labor Party vote tanked and the Greens reached like a total peak for them then. And I think that is probably because, and I think we're seeing a similar thing, where when the coalition's in power, everyone's like, just get these guys out. And then Labor's in power and a bunch of those voters are like, I don't really like what they're doing. I might vote for a minor party, independent, the Greens or whatever, to tell them to be better. Labor's majority is what, 2 seats or something right now? I don't see the Liberals getting close to a majority. I don't really see any gains the Labor Party is going to make. I think a hung parliament is probably the most likely outcome.
No, that's the worst thing in the world.
And the thing is someone like Anthony Albanese, who despite calling himself the socialist left guy or whatever, his antipathy to the Greens runs so deep, right? People who are from Sydney understand this. The idea of him, like, I don't know if it'll be like this, but I think it's conceivable to see a Tasmanian-style thing, right, where the Labor Party could feasibly form right now a government with the Greens and Lambie, but they just said, we don't want to do minority. We don't want to do that. If Albanese has the option to form a government with the Greens, I think he's probably more likely to say, fuck no, and hand it over to someone else.
I don't think that's true. If Labor, I think Tasmania is a slightly different kettle of fish in which Labor have fewer seats than the Liberals, right? Like, that's a factor that is... I think you need to factor into that. If Labor wins more seats than the coalition, but still can't make it over the line, I think that even Anthony Albanese will, through gritted teeth, find himself forming a minority government. I think.
We can test each other on this in 12 months.
Well, we will then.
See you then.
All right. Were there any others? Sorry. No, that was it.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, well, I actually was speaking to some great Tasmanian stuff. Thank you for that question. I was speaking to some Tasmanian Labor people in the aftermath of that, and I think there's a couple of different factors. I think there's obviously a faction that just wanted to blast her out and put themselves in, but I think the really fascinating thing in Tasmania, the last minority government under David Bartlett, I think 2014, 2018, even though that was, or perhaps earlier than that, that was like a pretty stable minority government with the Greens, and Bartlett is a big defender of it, Labor people are like,
well, Lara Giddings as well.
Yes,
right?
That's right. Yep. Labor people are like, well, that legitimized the Greens, and we're not here to do that. We're here to govern in our own right. And so I think that's what the Labor Party is trying to say here is like, we'd rather not govern than govern with the Greens. I think the problem they've got in Tasmania with Hare Clark proportional voting and the rise of the Greens and Lambie vote, Labor's never going to have a majority government.
Yeah.
So they've got to recognize that.
Yeah. That's a problem with a slightly better voting system, you know?
Yeah.
This fucking democracy.
Yeah.
God damn it.
Well, I'm very happy because Tabitha Badger is going to Hobart, baby.
Badger.
As are a bunch of others.
All right. We will leave it there. One more time. Please give a huge round of applause to Wonderful Osman Faruqi.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks, mate. Cheers. Listen to Oz's podcast, The Drop. It's fantastic. Yay! Green Jacket as well. Green Jacket. And please welcome to the microphone our producer, Michael the Griff Griffin.
Griff. Hi, thanks for coming, everyone. I just wanted to tell a story. So when I'm in Melbourne, I'm staying at Tom's spare room. And if you watch the... Well, yeah.
How much is he charging you?
He's... a wonderful tenant, and I'm charging below the market rate.
Wow. Or multiple properties in our case.
So if you've watched the video version of the podcast, like that's the spare room where he films it. And so I'm like sleeping inside the podcast. I don't know if you guys have been to like the Monopoly experience or the Friends experience, but I'm in like the Serious Danger experience.
The Serious Danger experience, baby.
That's how dedicated you are, sir.
You can sell tickets. Yeah.
All consuming.
We're selling merch.
Yeah, we're selling merch. I picked them up yesterday. They're hot off the presses. A few people have already been buying shirts. In fact, some are already selling out in certain colors and sizes. So if you want to grab yours, they're downstairs. We'll have a little desk in the corner of the room and you can come chat to us. We've got shirts. We've got white, dark gray, black, green, kind of blue, jade is the color. We got stickers as well. Come have a chat and buy them. Teal. They're teal. No, I refuse. They're not teal.
Did we get coal in the end?
Did we get what?
Coal?
We got the shade of the dark grey is actually coal. But, you know, we couldn't, obviously can't market it as that. So it violates our agreement.
Yeah. T-shirts are $35 and we got stickers for sale as well.
$3, got a few like left. Yeah. Yep.
And if I could be really gross, I would love you to come to my comedy festival show if you get a chance. It's all the rage. the critically acclaimed show. It's on at 6:10 at the Ridges Hotel. It's called Good Point Well Made. If you don't want to come to that, that's fine. You should come to the fundraiser that I'm doing with Will Anderson on the last Monday of the festival. It's a fundraiser for the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. It's called Stand Up for Refugees. Me and Will co-hosting an amazing lineup of secret amazing comedians. Would love you to come along to that if you get a chance. I think that's everything. Quickly, huge round of applause for Luke on tech here at the Wonderful Comedy Republic. Give it up for all the Wonderful Comedy Republic people. Oh, God. Thank you for listening to our podcast. We love doing this and we love you very much.
Thank you so much.
Good night, everyone. Thanks
for coming again.
Thank you.
This is a serious danger to Australia.